Hi, welcome to the ESI What's Next podcast. I'm your host, Alex Feldman, and I'm taking you on a journey to learn about the exciting student entrepreneurs coming out of the ESI program. In the first part of our mini-series, Are Robots Going to Take Our Farms Too?, we're sitting down with Martin Gallardo, Director of Innovation, Digital, and Growth at PwC, as well as a science fiction writer, to learn about how robotics will change the agricultural industry. Are we looking at a future where there are no longer any farmers working in the field, or is this an overblown fear? Hi, Martin. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today. Before we get into this, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Super. So, Martin, I'm director at PwC. I lead the innovation area with focus on startups and scale-ups. The last almost 10 years I've been working with in the innovation sphere. So I've been working with Accenture, PwC, and Bain, a company now that is part of Bain. And previously also as an entrepreneur. So I've started a couple of business, a couple of small exits. And on my spare time, I actually wrote a science fiction book and also a book about the future and how technologies are going to shape the world we live in. So this is a little bit of my background. I'm engineer by trade, and I'm very excited to be here today, Alex.
So I have sort of two different questions, and we'll start one for the other, just about your background. Let's say, what initially got you interested in working in the innovation space? Where does that come from?
That's a very good question. I think since I finished with the university, I really had a lot of passion for it, but of course I was very committed to working as an engineer. But on the side, I already started creating businesses with my friends. So the first business we created was actually a 3D printing business, and that was actually in 2011. So that was really at the hype of the 3D printing. We created sort of the Apple of the 3D printing of Spain, and that was very, very interesting process. We went very hype and we went very bust. And I think that ride was a huge learning, and I got very hooked into that. So since then, I have been always on the site. And whenever I had the chance to go all in, about 6-7 years ago, I have moved all into just working with the startups.
I have to ask, so I feel like a lot of people who start working in the innovation space don't really, at least in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong, don't necessarily go like the big consulting route. What made you decide to, because you've worked for, let's say, I mean, that's most of the big consulting firms that kind of exist. What made you decide to kind of become a consultant in this space compared to sort of the other sort of stakeholders you could be?
That's a very good question. I think there are just different routes and different paths of learning. I think what I really like from the consultant is that you are exposed to a lot of different things. Therefore, the learning that you can have is very rich. And I think for me, learning is sort of the process that I enjoy the most, right? So for me, being exposed to half dozen to a dozen of startups and scale-ups per year, talk to founders and find the problems and scale them, that has been very, very interesting. I have also been working with a corporate. So that also is a place where I can work both with the startups and the corporates. So I think it's a very interesting route. And I see more and more the capital is using consultants early on in the business life cycle, because they can bring a lot of experience from what they have seen, right? Nevertheless, of course, I have always on the side been working with my own side hustles, and that has been a different type of learning and really rich. And I don't think I will be able to live without both. So I did my entrepreneur on the side while I keep sort of more of a corporate job. We're still working with innovation.
I just imagine that I would, it's like, if I were you, let's put it in this way. I would imagine that, let's say, the way that you blend the two of these things together is that you essentially leverage what you're learning on the consulting side to help you identify opportunities to create side hustles in. Is that been kind of your the way that you operate?
That's true, and the other way around. And I will say even more of the other way around. But for sure, what you said is true. But I think even more, the fact that I can be a pirate outside of work is extremely interesting, right? Because it, for instance, with my website, I've been selling business templates and doing a lot of experiments for years, and I've tried a lot of concepts and I sold two of them, but that allowed me to be full pirate. So I didn't need to be, I can be full bootstrap. I can try things. I can learn technologies, tools, and I can apply them without a budget from anyone to approve or anything, right? So I think all of those things that I have learned, like going really deep and geeky into marketing technology or like Google Tags or whatever it is that is very geeky into bootstrapping, it has been fantastic to bring it back to my clients. But I could have never done it if I would not have been a pirate outside of work. So it is a bit of a synergy here.
So it sounds like to me that to a certain extent, by having these side hustles and side pirate projects, it actually lets you to, let's say, get much deeper on a specific subject matter than you would in kind of your consulting role. Is that kind of right? And then you can kind of bring it back because now you have unique expertise.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. I think without all the side hustles and the pirate bootstrapping, I think I will not be the same as I am. And I will not be able to advise my clients on things that are very lean, very targeted, very efficient, perhaps not that easy to find out. But then when you know about them, it's, oh yeah, it's obvious, right? But yeah, for sure, I will not be able to do what I do without the side way.
And just, I want to kind of do one last kind of line of question about your background, because we haven't really touched on this at all. Let's look at the other side of you for the fact that what made you also to be sort of become a writer in the space, do a bit of, I guess, right, part of it was science fiction, part of it was sort of more almost not right, the other part is a nonfiction, more speculative a little bit. Why did you decide to do that? Why did you decide to communicate in that way? I guess also why both kind of science fiction and kind of more kind of nonfiction? Or
yes, I get it. So I mean, when I was young, I love books. I think the books is the sort of the ultimate knowledge, I think, because it, in the old days, it really, it had to be condensed, the best of the best, right? And since I'm a kid, it has been always my dream to be a writer, actually, because most of what I learned when I was young was from books. So in a way, it's my own way of sort of paying back, right? So I got so much from them, and I also want to give to others. And I think that was the format that seemed sort of natural for me. And then I was writing actually two books. One of them was the research for the science fiction book. So I was collecting research for writing the science fiction. And at the end, I realized, but this is already a book. So that was actually the future is waiting, which is basically research. It's a series of articles about different technologies. And at that time, I was part of the Singularity University, not the full program, but the program for sort of candidates to be sort of top in each country. And at that time, I was actually between jobs, so I had plenty of time to write. So basically, my day will be wake up in the morning, have a coffee, write until my partner will come from work. So it was my full time was writing actually. So that was really fun until I joined consultancy. Then of course no more time. But yeah, it was a specific point of my life where I actually had the luxury of time.
Gotcha. Do you feel that, let's say, for the average person, that they need, let's say, that type of luxury of time to be able to write a book?
Well, if you are extremely consistent, if you are able to write, so I have a goal of writing 1,000 words a day. And if you are consistent, it's okay. You can write it even if you have little time, but you need to be very consistent and you need to have sort of your own target. And whatever you write during that day, some days you will write 300 words. Some of them you write someday 2,000. Some days 2,000 words of crap and it's useless. But you need to be consistent. And I think for whatever you do also within the innovation or side hustles, anything you do, you need to be consistent. And it's okay if you have only half an hour a day, But if you do it every day for 3 years, you got a noble.
Awesome. And I can think, kind of leading into to our general subject for the day, let's say what would be, let's say for your average person, what would be the biggest thing you'd want to sort of, you'd want them to know about sort of the future that's coming, about the tech that's coming? What should they be aware of?
I mean, for the average person, I don't think they must be aware of. I mean, we have been on a crazy ride with technology the last 20 years, and it's just going to get more of, it's going to be more of what we have experienced. But I think a couple of things they should be aware of. Technology influences in ways we sometimes don't even realize. So for instance, the phones, the amount of time we spend on the phones and the mental health. I think that's, mental health is going to be a pretty big thing over the next years, especially when we see that we are exposed more and more to more immersive type of technologies like VR, AR, all of that. I think this is something to be very mindful for you and also for your kids. And so I think mental health is something that people should be more aware of, for sure. The second thing is the amount of possibilities out there with the technology that we have today is insane. Most people, they know very, very, very little of what we can do. So I will say that instead of trying to complete a task or do something or innovate, spend enough time informing yourself about the possibilities of technology today. And from typical SaaS to AI, ML, also what are doing the startups and so on. So I think people are really not aware of the potential that is already today. And the third thing that I will say is biotechnology. I think biotechnology is going to be the revolution of this century. I am really sure about that. I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see insane progress, and people, we're going to start being B2C. We're going to see B2C startups that they are targeting us with in ways we have never imagined, like from predicting cancer to playing with our metabolism to reverse aging. All of those things we are going to start seeing more and more. So I think those three things, mental health, possibilities of technology for your business, and biotech, I think people are not that aware of, and they should be perhaps more aware of what's coming.
Awesome. Kind of shifting with, or using that as a lead into to kind of our conversation today, we want to talk a little bit about sort of robotics and how to use it in agriculture and whatnot. Let's start at kind of high level first and kind of then narrow down. Let's start here. Can you get into, let's say, I think most people potentially have a fear that you know, robots and AI is going to take over everything. But I think, let's say, both of us are in the innovation space. Let's say there's areas that robots are really good at, and there's areas that robots are, let's say, not so good at, and probably our fears are quite unfounded. Can you do a little bit of a breakdown of you know, where will robots take over, and where, you know, will they not? let's start there.
I mean, robots are in all ways, and when we say robots, is all different types of robots and technologies, and from mechanical robots to AI, so all the wide spectrum of robots and automation, of course, is here to stay and is going to penetrate more and more. What I think is some of the areas are going to be very difficult to displace. Whatever involves fast complex physical movements is going to be very difficult to replace by a robot. Perhaps at some point, but we are seeing with self-driving cars, for example. I mean, yes, but not as fast as we think, right? Also, nurses, for example, we see a crisis of lack of nurses. There will be some penetration of some use cases for the robots, but the job that a nurse can do is not something that a robot can do or will be able to do, not even a foreseeable future. What a nurse does is very complex, from lifting weights to handle small objects. It's a wide range of uses, of use cases, with strength, with also the human interaction. There's so much more, right? But there are places where the robot is going to penetrate more and more, like, for instance, surgery, also everything related to warehousing, logistics, all of that. Yes, absolutely. I mean, we see companies like Ocado or AutoStore, right? So they are, of course, penetrating. I think there is a huge, immense space for them. By the way, I invested on AutoStore just in case, in case someone comments. So there are some places where, of course, technology, but to be able to do some things that are very physical, I think it's going to be not as easy or as soon as we think so.
I think that's sort of right. One of the big things with sort of both AI and robotics is that generally speaking, it's really, really good at doing kind of a highly specific, highly specialized task. But when you start to do, let's say, add multiple tasks that have highly different skill sets, it becomes significantly more difficult to kind of have, and you know, they call it like kind of general intelligence, general physical activity, et cetera. It seems like that's where we haven't really found good solutions for something like that. Like you said, like a nurse is a good example, right? They have to do something that's, let's say, heavy lifting weights, but then kind of fine motor with sort of like needles and stuff like that. It sounds like echoing what you're saying there.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think when we see that it's very, very specific and we can automate it and it will always be sort of the same outcome, robots are infinitely better than us at repeating something with good quality. But when you have a wide range of things, as you said, it starts to be more and more complicated. So I think nurses, pretty good example. And there will also be other things like in the store, for example. So you need to do a lot of things on a store. Of course, you can automate a lot of the store, but for instance, interaction with the client, but also pulling objects, tagging them, replacing, seeing what is missing. I mean, there is plenty of things that typically what a human does is fairly complex. But yeah, I think, as I said, warehousing, a lot of ag tech. And that we, I guess, we will talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, I think I support your points, Alex.
So you mentioned agriculture, and that's where we want to get dive more into. I think before getting into, let's say, agriculture specifically, I think what do you see from, let's say, the research that you've done on the future are, let's say, the challenges within terms of, let's say, food supply, food production? Because I think before we start talking about agriculture, we kind of have to look at it on a macro scale. Is there anything that you noticed, any kind of, I don't know, predictions that you want to say or speculation on where we're going on that front?
So I think there is one massive topic that is a big elephant in the room, and people they are not really aware of that, and that's water. There is something massive with water. I think water is the new oil. So there is a lot of things that are going to be really related to how we handle water. So I think that's a mega trend that I think is here to stay, and especially with climate change, we are going to see that there is going to be a lot of disturbances with the water supply and the water quality. So I'm at the moment I'm actually working with a digital water scale up and also with a groundwater exploration company, both from Norway. And I was amazed at the use case and the business case of the water value chain. So water is one of the mega trends. Climate change is another of the mega trends. Another mega trend is the cycle for phosphorus and nitrogen. So basically the richness of the soil. So I think soil has been mistreated for almost a century with fertilizers and all of that. So I think that's if you look actually at the planetary boundaries, I think people are mostly aware about climate change, which actually we have not passed yet. Well, we have passed the 1.5, but basically, but there are other boundaries that we have really, really passed. I mean, one of them is partially the biosphere and the ecosystems, and sort of course the species, and of course then for soil we have passed several boundaries. So I think if we start with the mega trends, I think that's at the very, very high level. Then from the technological point of view, there are some mega trends that are coming together from several angles on the robotics and automation. And if you look at the AI and ML, it has become really sort of cheap or easy to deploy. I mean, there are solutions that are there that allow you to do machine learning as a SaaS on the cloud with APIs or even as a widget. It's extremely impressive for quite an affordable price. And more coming from Microsoft and others and what we call cloud AI, where you can actually deploy use cases at a fairly decent cost base. So I think we are going to be able to see that technology is really not a limitation if you have a loss problem. So I will focus more on the really big megatrends. And then, of course, when you look at the societal perspective as well, there are several megatrends. I mean, people will have a better standard of living. They will like to have more protein. So I think that is, and also higher quality food, and also more nutrients dense food. So there are also several trends with the demographics, if we want to put it that way.
There's a lot of trends. Let's focus a little bit on actually we can focus on all of this. Let's say of the trends that you see. And let's say, keeping it with me, what trends do you think are, let's say, ripe for implementation with robotics, and which ones are sort of, let's say, need other solution types to really address?
I think AI and machine learning is ready. So I think, and what I see when I'm saying ready, I think we are fully ready to optimize crops. I think we are fully ready to develop a lot of use cases with AI and with ML. And I think this year has been particularly powerful for AI and ML. I mean, if you see all the breakthroughs, and I've been very fond of OpenAI. I had one of the beta accounts. I've been playing with that. It's very impressive. And that also tells you like how far we have come, and it's really the breakthrough moment. I think it was very hype 3-4 years ago. But I think now I think we are at the point where this is really good stuff that we can implement.
But I guess my question a little bit, Martin, was do you see, let's say, on not necessarily the technology side, but on the challenges side, do you see AI as sort of the magic bullet to all these things? Or are there, let's say, particular problems that lend itself more to an AI ML robotic solution? Or are there others that kind of, yeah, we need something else here?
I think, yeah, that's if we look at the problems right now, I think that really, of course, burning problems. We have the energy crisis, so of course this is a massive thing. In my book, I actually predicted that we were going to have an energy crisis around this time, more or less, and getting increasingly worse until 2030. And people, they don't understand exponential curves. They just, that doesn't compute for the brain of humans. We think linear. And when you look at internet and the usage of internet, it was around, I wrote a few years ago, there was already 6, 7, or 8% of the global electricity was towards the internet, with everything, of course, from data centers to everything powering. But the internet is exponential. So and people, they don't realize that, okay, if let's say it's not 1% extra per year, it's like 1% and then 2% and then 4% and then 8%. And then you're already in 2025 and you're already 16-20% of the global energy. But it's an exponential. So by 2030, we are out of the game. So if we continue using with the same exponential curve on consuming data, we are going to have a pretty big problem. This is completely off the chart for a lot of people, but this is now, of course, with Russia invading Ukraine and the electricity prices becomes, of course, much more notorious. But if you look at Norway, for example, we are electrifying everything, right? Like from cars to boats, everything is batteries, everything is electric. And we see that the prices start going, and we actually have gas and we have hydropower. but prices starts to go up as well. Is much more difficult to handle the grid. So I think energy is going to be really hot topic the next few years as a challenge.
How do you think, here's a question from that, right? Is, okay, so on one side, we're going to have energy being increasing, but also on the other side, we have, let's say, the demand for something like protein increasing, which is sort of, let's say, of what we eat, kind of high energy. And how are we going to sort of, let's say, be as almost to a certain extent, right? How are we going to be able to balance our increased energy needs for using the internet compared to like our increased energy needs for, you know, eating different forms of protein? It seems like we're going to potentially have to make some difficult decisions coming up.
Yeah, I think a very interesting point. I think humans will want to live as comfortable as possible, right? So we will always try to have both the best of both worlds, right? So I mean, tell a millionaire that, oh, he's not going to fly in his jet to Dubai during the winter and have a Vaigu Japanese steak there, right? Of course he will do it, and a lot of people, if they will have the means, of course they will consume even more data, they will buy more blockchain type of assets, they will trade more online, they will buy more protein rich foods. I mean, it's, we all want to be more comfortable. So I to be honest, I don't have an answer of how we are going to deal with that, but it is coming. And we see, of course, if you, not that we all are going to live like in the States where they consume I mean, it's not only CO2, but the footprint is very high per person, but yeah, globally, when you lift up millions and millions of people in Africa and in Asia, they would like to consume more of the protein. And I think the way we have been living in Europe and the US is fairly unsustainable for like over 100 years. So it's if they want to live the same lifestyle that we have, it's going to be very difficult for the world.
Well, I think that's one of the things that let's say when I have conversations with people around the topic, one of the things that maybe I'm wrong, but I get the sense of, let's say, consumption in Europe and the US actually probably reached on an individual basis relative peak consumption relatively recently. And it's kind of very, I think, very much kind of reached peak. I think it's honestly come down a little bit or plateaued. But I think people don't realize that, let's say, in the general scheme of things for the planet, it's a relatively small percentage of the planet. And the rest of the planet is making its way up towards Europe and the US. And I've lived in a number of these countries, and, you know, all of a sudden, if you know, eight times as many people as Europe and the US are now consuming like Europe and the US, like we have a much bigger issue, as well as, I don't know, I would argue from a almost ethical point of view, I don't think we in the West can sort of turn around to these other groups of people and say, oh, no, you can't do this anymore. We've been living this way for 100 years. Now that it's your turn, you can't. It's going to destroy the planet and whatnot. I think it's really tricky, and I don't think people are quite, unless you've really traveled and lived in parts of Asia, gone to the Middle East. I don't think people are, South America. I don't think people are quite aware of how much of the world is coming up, how much of the world is coming online, and how much honestly greater in terms of numbers that isn't compared to how much we're doing it before.
Fully agree. I see the same picture, Alex. Exactly the same picture. And I agree with you. It's not ethical to tell them no. Now your turn has passed because we were more developed, and then we could use oil, right? With oil, which is, I used to work in the oil industry. Oil is an amazing resource. Okay, it's insanely good resource. We use everything of it, and it's fantastic. But it's very dirty. but we have been leapfrogging ourselves and living really, really good thanks to that. And now we are telling others not to do it. It's not fair, right? So if you look at a country like Norway is, I mean, I'm from Spain, but so half of my heart is in Norway after living almost half of my life now there. It is the cleanest and also the dirtiest country in the world. Because we export oil and gas, and also everything we produce, we actually import it. It's mostly import goods, right? So the CO2 is embedded in the trade. Actually, my professor at NTNU, They were sort of global experts on CO2 embedded in trade. So actually, a lot of the emissions from Norway are in China. But we blame China for the emissions, but we are actually buying everything from China. So if we account the emissions properly, say Norway is basically selling CO2, and it's also on top of that is sort of importing it. So it's per capita is really, really bad. But I mean, we are also doing some of the best in the world, right? So we are trying to electrify society, move to, we are injecting CO2 on the seabed. I mean, we are doing a lot of cool stuff as well. So it's never black and white. Life is a rainbow, and we need to, yeah, accept all sides, right? But it is a very difficult problem to solve. I think I have seen it. I was very pessimistic on climate change, for example, for many years. For 10 years, I've been working with, especially for 5-6 years, I was very into working as a climate change consultant and traveling the world for that. And it's a very difficult problem to solve. Very, very difficult. I don't think we will solve it. We will have to adapt.
Sure. Okay. Interesting thing. I think, unfortunately, we're going to kind of have to wrap this up. I don't want to wrap up right there. I think let's give you one more final thought. Any final thoughts before we go?
No, I think I would like to see like the world moving at a faster pace, and I think the main thing is to inspire the best people out there to tackle the challenges and be really brave and solve them at the scale. And it's not to have good ideas. I think good ideas are great, but we need to have the ecosystem of players that are really engaged into solving these type of challenges, and a lot of money for scale. So I work with a lot of startups, but I work also with scale-ups. And what I see with the scale-ups is that they underestimate by a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000 what it is to deploy their technology worldwide at all potential. I mean, and honestly, I work with companies that if their technology will be implemented worldwide, we will reduce emissions by 1-2.5%. Like I'm talking about really, really impressive change, but they will need $10-100 billion to be able to do that on at least 10 or dozens of billion dollars of capital. But it's better to invest on a food delivery app, right? So it's an ecosystem of entrepreneurs, is venture capital, is government. They all need to come together to help these very inspiring people to tackle it and give them really the funds that they need to deploy at the scale. But I see, yeah, the venture capital has been, of course, focusing too much on quick money and instead of actually sort of long-term impact. But we see a lot of changes in the last year. So I'm hopeful that at least the ecosystem is changing, or at least new actors are coming into that sphere, especially climate investing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the ESI What's Next podcast. ESI is a program aimed at fostering socially responsible, environmentally sustainable student innovation through education and new venture creation. We're grateful to the European Regional Development Fund, Printify, SEB Bank, and Remy for their support. Tune in next week to find out what's next in the world of student entrepreneurship.